Welcome to the Political Rewind. I'm Madhani Muturi. Today, the latest on the Minnesota Senate race saga. And Michael Steele apologizes. Again. Before all that, though, a look at the president's temperamental policy man.
The White House decision to avoid a fight with Congress on earmarks is a legislative strategy that sounds a great deal like Rahm Emanuel, who was formerly a top-ranking Democrat in the House leadership. He is now President Obama's chief of staff, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Every president staffs the White House his own way, and President Obama decided to pack his with powerful figures like economic advisor Larry Summers, energy czar Carol Browner, and James Jones, the retired four-star general who's now the national security advisor. Josh Bolton, who was President Bush's last chief of staff, once predicted that the toughest challenge for Mr. Obama's chief of staff would be fitting all those strong-willed personalities into the small space of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
I thought he was talking about me.
That's Rahm Emanuel, no shrinking violet himself. He has a larger-than-life personality and a reputation to match. His big office in a sunny corner of the West Wing is neat and uncluttered. There are pictures of his wife and three kids, but also a brass plaque that reads, Undersecretary for Go Bleep Yourself. It was a gift from Emanuel's brothers and a reference to his penchant for profanity. When Emanuel was a teenager, he lost part of his right middle finger in a meat slicer while working at Arby's in his native Chicago. President Obama has joked that accident rendered Emanuel almost mute.
This whole myth of Rahm being this tough guy, mean, is just not true. You know, at least once a week, he spends time teaching profanity to underprivileged children.
No one who's ever worked with Rahm, including the president, calls him Emanuel. He's one of those political celebrities known by just one name, like Newt or Hillary. He's been called Rambo for his super-aggressive style and sometimes outrageous behavior. There was the dead fish he sent to a pollster, the time he stabbed a steak knife into a table for emphasis, or jumped up and down on a desk while making fundraising calls for Bill Clinton. He says there are the stories, apocryphal or accurate, and then there's the real person.
I'm a very driven person on behalf of what I'm trying to get done for the president, or when I was running for Congress, or on behalf of the constituents I represented. I'm driven, but I have a staff, when they work for me, incredibly loyal because of my loyalty to them. And you can't get that if all you do is just be a hard driver.
Leon Panetta, who was President Clinton's chief of staff and Emanuel's boss at the time, shared this memory in an interview before he was nominated to be CIA director.
When he came into my office in the mornings, and he used to be yelling and screaming about some of the problems, I'd say, you know, Rahm, you really do strike me as an Italian. And he said, does that mean I can marry your daughter? I guess the best way to say it is that he's matured a great deal. He used to be somebody who didn't listen very well, and now, frankly, he does take the time to listen to people, and that's a strength that you need to have if you're back in the White House.
Emanuel himself says his time after the Clinton administration, in the private sector and in the House, changed him.
You got to know when to press down on the accelerator when people basically don't want to move or don't want to make a decision. And you got to know when to pull back and let that process kind of develop. I tell all the folks, I said, I'm a hard charger. And I said, you want, just grab me by the collar when you think I'm going too fast.
More than any other recent chief of staff, Emanuel has thrown himself into the legislative process. He negotiated the final stimulus bill for the White House, cutting deals with the three moderate Republican senators and the House and Senate Democratic leadership. Like his new boss, he was flexible and pragmatic, willing to make a deal, almost any deal, to win. And his approach impressed even House Republicans. Jim Gerlach represents a swing district in Pennsylvania. He was always on the top 10 list of targets when Emanuel ran the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Gerlach says Emanuel is a partisan Democrat, but he's not an ideological one, not necessarily even a liberal. Emanuel didn't get any House Republican votes on the stimulus bill, but he tried, inviting Gerlach and other moderates to meet with him at the White House.
We all appreciated that. We hope we have an ongoing relationship now where we can talk about issues and hopefully get good things done in the future.
But other Republican moderates say Emanuel got distracted recently when he picked a fight with Rush Limbaugh after the conservative talk show host said he wanted the president and his policies to fail. Here's Emanuel on CBS's Face the Nation.
It's our desire that the Republicans would work with us in trying to be constructive rather than adopt the philosophy of somebody like Rush Limbaugh who's praying for failure. I mean, he is the voice
and the intellectual force and energy behind the Republican Party.
All of a sudden, it was Rombo versus El Rushbo, a food fight that may have been good politics, but perhaps better waged by the White House press secretary or the party chair instead of the chief of staff.
I've known him since he was 22 years old, so nothing surprises me about Rom, least of all when he succeeds.
That's David Axelrod, the president's senior advisor, who, like the rest of the tight-knit team of Obama White House aides, admires the chief of staff's effectiveness and has a soft spot for his antics.
He's not as athletic as he was as a young man. He doesn't jump on desks. He counts to 10 more. He's matured, as people do over time, but he still gets excited from time to time, and it's fun to watch.
Fun to watch in private. Rom is always on his best behavior in public. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Republican Party Chairman Michael Steele is in hot water again. Last month, he picked a fight with radio host and Republican icon Rush Limbaugh. Now he has angered an even more formidable force in the party, the pro-life establishment. NPR's Julie Rovner examines whether Steele can survive his latest stumble.
Steele is under fire for comments he made in an interview with GQ magazine. It was posted on the publication's website last night. In the interview, Steele said he thinks that abortion is, quote, an individual choice. Pressed by the interviewer to confirm that, Steele replied, yeah, absolutely. By this morning, the chairman was desperately trying to backpedal. I am pro-life, always have been, always will be, he said in a written statement released through the Republican National Committee. Both he and the RNC declined to respond on tape today, but the damage was already done.
I'm appalled, of course, at one level, but at another level, I'm not at all surprised because we've never really suspected that Mr. Steele was pro-life to begin with.
Judy Brown is president of the American Life League, an anti-abortion rights group. Brown says she suspects that this latest Steele uproar will result in a lot of debate, but she doubts it will cost him his job. Because, she says, the Republican Party has, for a while, been trying to separate itself from its pro-life supporters.
It's one thing to have a beautiful statement in the party platform, but it's quite another to watch the way they actually behave. And the Republican Party, for the most part, is not really that committed to protecting children in the womb.
Republican strategist and former Congressman Vin Weber disagrees with Brown. He does think Steele is committed to the anti-abortion cause.
Michael is an observant Catholic and a genuine pro-lifer. He answered the question awkwardly from a standpoint of pro-lifers, but I don't think that it's going to sort of tip the house over, if you will.
But while Weber doesn't think the abortion spat alone will cost Steele his position, he stopped short of saying the new chairman's job is safe.
I've been talking to a lot of people who are raising serious questions about his chairmanship, and he's got to right the ship very quickly. I'm supportive of him. I'd like to be helpful to him, but a lot of people are worried.
Weber says the problem is not what's going on in public, but what's going on in the back offices of the RNC. Steele fired the existing staff when he took over and has been criticized for being slow to replace them. There's still no top fundraiser, and he didn't name a chief of staff until this week. Meanwhile, says Weber, the party badly needs to catch up to Democrats in terms of technology and fundraising.
And I'm not suggesting that Michael Steele is ignoring those things, but his critics and concerned Republicans around the country look at the gaffes that we are reporting, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or the abortion issue, and they think, why is he doing that when he should be worrying about raising money and getting us competitive organizationally?
Steele, the party's first African-American leader, was far from a consensus pick to head an opposition party out of power and in seeming disarray. He won the RNC job in January after six separate rounds of balloting. And in a bad omen for him today, there was no rush of RNC members publicly coming to his defense. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
I'm Madhani Muturi, and it's the Political Rewind. Finally today, Coleman versus Franken. The drama continues.
The Constitution says each state, no matter how big or how small, shall have two U.S. senators. But at the moment, Minnesota has one. That's because the top contenders for the other Senate seat, Republican incumbent Norm Coleman and Democratic challenger Al Franken, are locked in a court battle. It followed a recount of the November election giving Franken a 225-vote lead. That's out of nearly 3 million votes cast. Lawyers for both candidates presented closing arguments today. Appeals are expected, and as NPR's David Wellner reports, the patience of a lot of Minnesotans is wearing thin.
Until January, Democrat Amy Klobuchar was Minnesota's junior senator. Now she's both junior and senior senator. Klobuchar admits being a bit of an oddity as the state's lone representative in the U.S. Senate.
It is fun to be a stop on the Capitol tour, saying there she is, the only senator. We don't have a lot of friction in our delegation, but it's getting a little old.
Klobuchar says for her, the most immediate impact of not having another Minnesota senator is that it's fallen to her staff to handle all constituent services, and it's taken a toll.
Because they've literally been doing double the work, especially in Minnesota. We've seen a doubling of our casework. And this isn't just people calling about vote this way, don't vote this way. These are people who have real problems, especially with today's economy. Veterans benefits, a Social Security check that doesn't show up, a baby they're trying to adopt in Guatemala that's stalled out because of red tape, and they show up at our office with the picture of the baby.
And while lawyers for Norm Coleman and Al Franken are battling in a St. Paul courtroom, other Minnesotans are complaining. Brooke Bice is a hotel sales manager from the Twin Cities suburb of Robbinsdale.
It is what it is. Let's just get on with the show and get someone there to represent us.
Ann Lease of Minneapolis, who voted for Franken, says her patience, too, is flagging.
I'm willing to go along with the process. I do believe in the process. I believe it's important, given that this was the closest election in Senate history. I do think that it's important that the recount went forward, but I am becoming frustrated with the ensuing court cases. And since there doesn't seem to be an end in sight, that has me worried.
Republicans who voted for Coleman are also growing weary, including Minneapolis banker Preston Koenig.
From what I'm listening to on the news, it's become kind of an old story that they're tired of. And so I kind of feel that same way myself, that it's time to wrap this up and get on with business and do what we need to do to get somebody in the Senate.
Back at the U.S. Senate, though, Republicans seem to be in no hurry to have the Minnesota standoff resolved. John Kyle, the number two Republican, is his party's chief vote counter. Kyle says that what's really at issue is the Democratic majority's ability to find 60 votes to stop a GOP filibuster, which is why Republicans are happy to have frontrunner Franken tied up in court rather than seated in the Senate.
Someone who is not here automatically doesn't count as a vote. They need to produce 60 votes. I don't need to produce 41, so it's really not an issue for me. It's more of an issue for the majority leader.
And for the assistant majority leader, Dick Durbin. The Illinois Democrat is his party's chief vote counter. And with 58 members currently in the Democratic caucus, he says it hasn't been easy rounding up 60 votes to break GOP filibusters.
Every important vote so far has been a death-defying struggle to find one or two more senators. So the absence of a senator from Minnesota has complicated the early days of the session.
With today's closing arguments before a three-judge panel, Coleman's initial court challenge to the recount results may soon come to an end. If he loses, there's a strong possibility he'd appeal to Minnesota's Supreme Court, and then quite possibly all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Amy Klobuchar is now hedging her bets on how long she'll remain Minnesota's sole senator.
I am predicting when the ice melts on Lake Minnetonka. That's April 11th. I'm now maybe amending it to when the ice melts on Rainy Lake. That would be on the Canadian border. That would be May 1st.
And anything later than that?
Well, there's always the Arctic. And I am not ready to concede that.
David Wellner, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to The Political Rewind. And if you want more politics, and you know you do, join NPR's Political Junkie at npr.org.